Try to get started. People could grab their coffee and or sandwiches. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming this morning. A few admin announcements first. If you could turn off cell phones, that would be appreciated. Also, hopefully, they were handing out note cards. If you have questions that you'd like to ask General McMaster in our Q&A period, if you could jot them down, our staff will pick them up and we will. Bring them, and my fine colleagues over here, J.P. Pellegrino from the Marine Corps and Nate Fryer, will pose them on your behalf when we get to the Q&A period. So if you need a card, just put your hand up and they'll bring you some, and if you have them, just make them aware, and some able, young, energetic person will come grab it from you. First of all, let me say thanks again for coming today to our second event of the Ground Forces Dialogue, and we are in the process of continuing to build that dialogue out, and we'll be adding, hopefully, significant amounts of content to our website and other platforms this week, so we're really looking forward to getting into that aspect of the dialogue and having all of you help us build out the content over time. And So please do go to our site and register and follow us and friend us and all of that kind of good stuff. And a key part of this that is made possible through our support from BAE and Northrop Grumman is to have great people like H.R. McMaster come and talk with us about critical elements of issues affecting ground forces. So. If ever there was a man who needs no introduction, it's probably General McMaster, both a student and a teacher of history, but also more uncommonly among that crowd, I think someone who's made it more than once, and no doubt will continue to do so going forward, not only in decisive battles in Operation Iraqi Freedom, but in his efforts with the 3rd ACR in Tal Afar and in Afghanistan, and now as the commanding general of the Maneuver Center of Excellence at Fort Benning. So, sir, we're really honored to have you here. We appreciate you coming, and we look forward to your comments and then questions.
Martin, thanks so much, and thanks for the opportunity to be here at CSIS. You know, this is a great institution that does tremendous research that I drew heavily on, and many of us did, over the last 12 years of conflict, and it's a real privilege to be here with you and to be at CSIS and to see so many old friends here as well. So thank you.
Just want to dive in?
Sure. Really, what I'd like to do is see what's on all of your minds in terms of what our priorities are within the Maneuver Center at Fort Benning and really across our Army, as we all recognize that we're in a period of transition, between you know, these last 12 years of conflict, remembering, you know, that we still have 66,000 troops in Afghanistan, and we have to finish that fight strong. But we do have an opportunity, really a need, to make a grounded projection into the future, to institutionalize what we've learned over the last 12 years, and then obviously to take a look at potential adversaries, enemies, and the operational environment in the future, and to make sure that Army forces are prepared, despite obviously, you know, obvious fiscal constraints these days, to accomplish the mission as part of the joint force and multinational and interagency forces in the future. So that's what we're endeavoring to do at the Maneuver Center, is to make sure that our maneuver forces are prepared to fight and win and to contribute to the accomplishment of outcomes in future armed conflict that are consistent with our vital interests. And to do that, we are emphasizing four key areas of responsibility that is consistent really across all of the Army's centers of excellence. The first is General Odierno's top priority, which is leader development. And, you know, of course, leader development is important in a maneuver force because soldiers will follow a good leader anywhere under any conditions of battle. And so we have to work every day as our top priority to ensure that our maneuver leaders from corporal to colonel are prepared to provide the purpose, motivation, and direction to our soldiers in training, in preparation for combat, and during combat operations. So that's our top priority, and there are a lot of exciting, I think, developments in that area. Those involve, to some extent, technology, the application of advanced technology to distance learning and interactive learning and social learning, the idea of a flipped classroom where you can get a lot of your base work done and then really have the kind of interactions within the classroom that get you to a higher degree of mastery over certain skills, and other technologies that I think will allow us to make our education of leaders more realistic, and have to rely less on live training, for example, more realistic situational decision-making exercises and so forth, the ability to immerse leaders into these complex environments where we've found ourselves with not only an enemy, but an enemy that is intermingled with the civilian population and in environments where ethnic, tribal, religious dynamics affect what you're trying to achieve militarily. The emphasis in leader development is really, though, more conceptual than it is technological. And so what we are doing now is inventorying, really, all of the competencies we want to develop in our leaders at whatever level of responsibility. And then to identify, the knowledge, skills, abilities, and attributes that we want to develop so that we develop to get to those competencies. And then that will be a basis that's almost complete now. That will be a basis for auditing all of our learning outcomes for all of our courses at Fort Benning. And we will understand much better what we do in the institutional Army in terms of everything from really basic training all the way through all of our leader development courses and our functional training courses, but also to understand what we don't do and what has to happen in units. And so we're working very closely with our forces command units, our fielded units, so that we divide that work and we have continuity in that effort in the area of leader development, and again are working together to accomplish those competencies. And in doing so, we're applying the adult learning model of education to prepare for an immersive, challenging experience, then making sure that our leaders have those experiences to deepen their competency within branch competencies, infantry and armor for us, but all of them have to be combined arms leaders and understand how to integrate all arms and other capabilities into the fight to seize, retain, and exploit the initiative. And we're working to identify then what also happens in leader development in units, and working with the pre-command course officers who command battalions and brigades, to help them, give them the tools so they can develop professional military education programs in units and so forth. The other component of this will be so that those experiences in their units, part of those experiences will be broadening experiences. Our Army G1 has figured out a way to adjust the timeline for officers to provide two windows for broadening officers across their careers so they can bring different perspectives to their responsibilities as they assume a broader range of responsibilities and have to operate in complex environments. And then after those experiences, the opportunity to sort of unpack what they've learned and prepare for the next level of responsibility. So that conceptual foundation is, I think, firm. We're pretty confident in that now. And then, of course, it'll all be all about implementation. An aspect of this will also be self-study and to give our leaders the tools that they need to study across their careers. And so we're developing a maneuver leader self-study program. Now, of course, this is an area that I think is most important and also doesn't cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. We're moving out very enthusiastically about in this area. The second area is training. Make sure that our soldiers have the skills that they need to fight and survive and win in combat. And one of the things that General Cohen, our TRADOC commander, has said is in this time of fiscal austerity, what we won't do is go back to 2001 and throw away a lot of the innovations and adaptations that we've had since 2001 that has really improved the combat effectiveness of our force and improved the readiness of each of our soldiers. And this is training in the cognitive domain, for example. One of those programs and efforts that are ongoing is advanced situational awareness training so that soldiers really have the skills, the base level skills, to be able to identify the presence of the extraordinary, the absence of the ordinary. The other skills that we're developing within our maneuver soldiers, which are our infantry, our scouts, and our tankers, are skills that are necessary to operate in the complex environments in which we've been operating. So really how to understand the basics, be familiar really with cultural and political dynamics that affect your mission, be able to go in at least asking the right questions. And then also to have some very specific skills associated with, for example, tactical questioning, sensitive site exploitation. And we think for our scouts in particular, to be able to develop the situation, really gain understanding in close contact with civilian populations. And so for our scouts, that's going to, I think, migrate into our force, some skill sets previously associated with law enforcement and some skill sets previously associated with special forces. And those are in the areas mainly of foreign internal defense and combat advisory skill sets. So we want to develop those first in our reconnaissance formations. So if there is a Mali-type scenario, for example, and a brigade is deploying there, that reconnaissance squadron has the ability to connect with indigenous forces, develop understanding really alongside those indigenous forces while providing them with combined arms capabilities, communication, and so forth necessary maybe to secure an area in advance of follow-on operations or as part of an effort to prevent conflict and shape an environment consistent with our interests. So that training we're not going to compromise on. We're going to continue that training. And then lots of other, you know, adaptations in rifle marksmanship. And I mean, it's really been a revolution in the way we train at Fort Benning. We're not going to step back from that. The third area, again, another one that doesn't cost a lot of money is doctrine. And so what we want to do is lay a sound conceptual foundation for how we fight together as combined arms teams within our brigades and then below that. And so we're rewriting all of our doctrine in the next year. And that doctrine will be different in three really big ways. It'll obviously advance really how we describe our conduct of operations consistent with our two fundamental Army competencies, combined arms maneuver and areas, wide area security. But it will also begin with a threat chapter. You know, it became fashionable in the 90s to have, you know, just think that we're going to develop our force capabilities-based, right? Mm-hmm. But what we really, I think, have to be able to do is understand the problem we're trying to solve. You know, what are the capabilities that we see being developed in potential enemy and adversary organizations? What are the nature of those organizations? What sort of goals and objectives do they have? How are they going to fight? And then what sort of tactical capabilities will they have in those organizations? And so the trends are kind of no-brainers, right? We're going to see more IEDs. We're going to see more, you know, mines and so forth to take away our advantages in mobility. But our advantage in mobility is also rotary wing. We're going to see more air defense weapon systems and shoulder-fired air defense weapon systems. We're going to see really networked enemy organizations that have, and non-state actors potentially, who have capabilities previously associated only with nation states. And we'll see a proliferation of anti-tank weapon systems. AT-5 is a good example of that if you look at the 2006 Lebanon War. And we'll see a great deal more rockets and missiles as threats that we'll have to contend with, along with UAVs and weaponized UAVs. So this really is the kind of environment we're going to describe up front in our doctrine in a threat chapter. And then we're going to emphasize, maybe not surprising for those of you who know me, we're going to have a chapter on reconnaissance and security in every one of our manuals. And that is because we think this has become a lost art in large measure based on, you know, what I would describe as the faith-based argument of the 1990s, that we would be able to have a high degree of situational understanding in complex environments based on advances in technical intelligence collection capabilities, surveillance capabilities, and so forth. And what we have found is there are enemy countermeasures to those capabilities, dispersion, concealment, intermingling with civilian populations, and deception. There are also technological countermeasures that we see being developed now. GPS jammers, EMP type effects on our communications systems. So we are going to have, our forces are going to have to be able to develop situational understanding in close contact with the enemy and with civilian populations. And so the fundamentals of reconnaissance and security are more important than ever. And I would say that they're important in Afghanistan today, right? One of those fundamentals of reconnaissance is gain and maintain contact with the enemy. We do a great job gaining contact with the enemy, especially when we're initiating raids against networked enemy organizations. We haven't been able to do as well in maintaining contact with the enemy. In terms of the fundamentals of security to conduct continuous reconnaissance, for example, how do we integrate all the systems we've developed, all those great capabilities, you know, so that we can do a better job in security operations and so forth. And then the final change in our doctrine is we're going to have a chapter which is tentatively titled Shape, Influence, and Consolidate, which will cover all the things we've done over the past 12 years that did not appear in our manuals previously. And actually, we've done them, we've had to do all these things in the past 250 years of American military history. So this will include foreign internal defense type operations, building partnership capacity, but it will provide sort of keys to success for those operations, and will emphasize the politics, put the politics first in these operations. It will also emphasize military support to governance, rule of law, and development efforts, and it will also emphasize communication to clarify our intentions, counter enemy disinformation and propaganda, bolster legitimacy of our partners. Hopefully, they deserve that bolster of legitimacy, and so I think this is going to be a very useful for us in the future, and we'll also emphasize integration with law enforcement. And the fourth area where there will probably be the most questions on is combat developments. Now, based on where we see the threats developing, we think we have some really important priorities underway that we've got to continue to emphasize even in a period of fiscal austerity. One of those is called Squad Foundation of the Decisive Force. We don't want fair fights. I don't think any Americans want their army, want their soldiers, or any of their servicemen and women to have a fair fight against the enemy. And the formation now that has a fair fight against the enemy are infantry squads, because they're the ones who have to make close contact and then respond oftentimes to enemy-initiated contact, because that enemy is dispersed or concealed or intermingled with civilian populations. So the squad is as foundation of the decisive force effort, which we have information on that we could provide to you, is a short essay about it, is really to develop capabilities internal to the squad associated with things you would imagine you would want in your infantry squad, additional firepower and lethality, but also to lighten the load, to restore a higher degree of mobility to our infantry squad so we can conduct fire and maneuver dismounted. And then also some initiatives to give our squads better connectivity so they can coordinate with adjacent units and bring to bear all arms capabilities, army fires, joint fires, and surveillance capabilities, and so forth. Again, with an emphasis on trying to make contact on your own terms, but if you can't, to be able to fight and win any counteractions with the enemy. And extend, really, the depth that they cannot see and operate across as well. To see and fight across a wider area is a part of it. So that's our squad's foundation, decisive force. We also are looking across all of our combat formations. And what we have recognized as we have done that is that our adaptations, necessary adaptations across the last 12 years of war, have biased our formations perhaps too heavily in favor of protection at the expense of firepower and mobility. So what we want to do is get a rebalance back with the right balance of firepower, protection, and mobility across all of our formations. So how can we do that? Well, the first thing is to make sure that our combat vehicles are going to be able to operate effectively, fight and win, overmatch the enemy in future armed conflict. To do that, we need to modernize our combat vehicle fleet. The Bradley will soon be past its usefulness. I love the Bradley. I mean, I've been on the Bradley in combat many times, and I absolutely love it. It's a great chain gun. You can pivot steer. You can go in urban terrain. You can drive through courtyards, walls, and it has applicability, in the urban fights that we've been in recent years. And if you can imagine a larger scale contingency against a nation state and its fielded forces, but we need to stay ahead of our enemies. We know that underbelly protection is not where we'd like it to be. That has a lot to do with ground clearance now and the overburdening of the vehicle that's limiting its mobility as well. And we know as we face long-range weapon systems like the AT-5 at ranges of 5 kilometers and beyond, we need to upgun the weapon system, to something bigger chain gun type capability. We want to take advantage of some emerging and classified technologies that can help reduce the signature of those vehicles across different spectrums. And we also need to carry a 9-soldier infantry squad. And I'll be happy to take any questions you got, why it's 9 and why we need to be able to have a vehicle that can really allow our squads to dismount in positions of advantage over the enemy and protect them, but as they get into that position of advantage, as you transition from combinations of from a mounted movement to fire maneuver using mounted and dismounted techniques. But it's more than just a GCV. We're also looking across all of our armored vehicles, because if you look at the lead time for combat development, you can't have either or. You can't just say, I'm going to develop this great vehicle by 20 whatever and then not do anything with the current fleet. It's because it's going to take too long. We're going to buy fewer, less frequently, so we can continue to modernize. So we also need to modernize the vehicles that we've had and have stood the test of time. Part of the restoring of mobility to our formations is an armored multi-purpose vehicle. We have 113s, you know, from the Vietnam era that, you know, I know none of us in our right minds were ever allowed to go off a forward operating base because the enemy targeted them, because they know it was an easy way to inflict casualties on our soldiers. So how do we get that into our armored forces quickly? Right now we're hearing it's 2021 maybe to be able to do that. I mean, we're the United States of America, you know. I think we could, I mean, it's not an expensive vehicle. I think we could probably do this faster than 2021. So that's a big gap in our armored formations now. And then if you look at our striker formations, you know, all of these formations have advantages and disadvantages. We can talk about that. In our striker formations, we need to look both really across all of our formations at our reconnaissance formations. We're going to reorganize them, make them more effective, but also mobile protected firepower within our striker units. And looking for what comes next after the MGS, which is a vehicle that we've only procured 33% of. And then how do we support our infantry brigade combat teams in early entry and forcible entry operations? We should not have to have the John Abizade in Grenada in the future as a Ranger Company commander having to commandeer a bulldozer to close with a machine gun after jumping in to seize an airfield. What we need to provide a mobile protected firepower capability to our infantry formations that's not a 70-ton answer for everything. So that's another one of our areas of emphasis as well. A lot more in area of combat developments, but those are the four areas that we're focused on at Fort Benning to ensure the combat effectiveness of the current and future maneuver force. Its leader development is a top priority, training, doctrine, and education. And I'm sorry if I went on too long, but I do get carried away. And I'm happy to talk about anything beyond that as well. But I thought that might be enough to spark any questions you might have.
Thanks very much for that overview. I wanted to back up a little bit, and if people can run around and start gathering questions, and I'll ask a few. Taking a step back, I think there are these larger strategic questions of which you're well aware about how are we even going to use maneuver forces in the future? Are we going to do wide area security anymore? What does maneuver mean as we're expecting to not get involved in major conflicts of any scale? So how do you put all of your efforts into that broader strategic context?
Well, I think that the key thing is obviously to look at history and make a grounded projection forward, but then to understand really what the trend lines are in terms of emerging enemy capabilities, but inform that view of emerging enemy and adversary capabilities by what we see in terms of the geostrategic, geopolitical landscape and broader threats that are emerging to American national security. Now, obviously, you know, we have defense planning scenarios and so forth, but I think that there are a number of scenarios that are quite troubling, you know, and there is still obviously a tremendous potential for, you know, for conflict between nation states. We see, for example, we know what the IRGC has been doing, you know, for a long time. You know, this essentially in Iraq, they were fighting a proxy war against us, and are fighting a different kind of subversive campaign in Afghanistan, but also across the region with support for the Assad regime, Hamas, Hezbollah, you could say the Houthi rebels potentially in Yemen and so forth. So I think what we see as a threat emerging is what many have called, and I think quite rightly, this hybrid threat, where you have organizations that attack your vital interests and those of your allies through proxy forces and provide them with capabilities that were previously only associated with nation states. So what we'll need is we will need forces that can defeat those organizations and establish security conditions for us to remove what we may see as a threat to our vital interests. You know, there's been a great deal of talk, as you know, about air-sea battle. And of course, the most critical areas for us to have freedom of navigation in the world are those that move through constricted areas, through straits and so forth. And what we see is enemy organizations who can employ sophisticated capabilities, but are almost impossible to protect. I mean, just think about Hezbollah's sinking of Israeli warship, in 2006. That's a non-state actor with a short-of-ship missile that sunk a naval vessel. Now, who did that? Were the Israelis able to detect that in advance? Of course not. Were they able to find it afterwards? So it's going to really take a joint capability for us to be able to, if we're concerned about freedom of navigation and defeating enemy anti-access, for us to be able to transition rapidly deploy to an area, to either turn an enemy out of one of these positions or envelop an enemy force. In our language, that force would conduct a zone or an area reconnaissance to confirm or deny the presence of that enemy, transition to offensive operations to defeat that enemy, and then transition into a security operation to consolidate gains, turn over to another force or so forth. And there are many examples I think we could see where that's feasible in the future. The other particularly troubling scenario is obviously weapons of mass destruction and proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, based on a failed state or based on terrorist insurgent guerrilla type forces gaining control of those materials. And again, this is a problem you can't solve through the projection of firepower onto land from the aerospace and maritime domains. And so there are a number of contingencies we could look at associated with hostile states, I think. Hostile states developing nuclear weapons, I think, is certainly a plausible scenario, as is, of course, North Korea, who just abrogated their ceasefire, which is troubling as well, along with the nuclear tests and missile tests. I mean, we could go on and on, obviously, and we didn't even touch on the Middle East or some of the conflicts in Africa and northern Nigeria, what we see happening in Mali in terms of smaller scale, I mean, actually, both could be larger scale contingencies, and what the trend lines are associated with the Levant, North Africa, and so forth. So, I mean, I think what you often hear about that the future is going to be a lot more secure, or you sometimes hear in some recent studies that say that we won't be strategically surprised in the future, and we won't need to have, the kind of capabilities that we've had in the past. I just don't see it when I look at the geopolitical landscape and what the trend lines are.
Let me ask one more quick one. You've touched on it a little bit. In the spirit of the day, what are your big takeaways, lessons learned from the last 12 years? And then are there lessons that you think we might have learned that we shouldn't have?
Okay. Well, that's a great question. I think that at a high level of generality, I think what we have learned, it wasn't new. We've relearned some things. And I think what we've done is rediscovered some continuities in war and warfare. And I think that if you go back and read some of the literature associated with concepts like rapid decisive operations and shock and awe, for example, dominant battle space knowledge and so forth in the 1990s, I think what we became enamored with what we saw as changes in technology and that technology's application to war and warfare, and forgot to consider the continuities. And the continuities, I think, are in really four key areas. And this is one that I think we maybe continue to neglect as we look toward the future sometimes as well, is that war is an extension of politics. And the problems that we face, the security problems we face, are land-based because people live there, and they're politics-based because they involve oftentimes competition for power, resources, or power and survival. And in these conflicts on that emanate from land, I think we can see trends that are consistent across areas that have much different local realities associated with the conflicts, but the political competition is similar. So and that I think can be described quickly as really parties that are in conflict with one another, competing for power and resources, and one of those aggrieved parties is approached by a transnational terrorist organization or a hostile state who portrays itself as a patron and protector of that aggrieved party. So a local conflict very quickly grows to a much larger conflict. And many of these organizations, Takfirist or Salafi jihadist organizations associated with al-Qaeda, have political ambitions and want to control people and territory. I think one of the things that is amusing to me sometimes is that we talk about sea control, which is an important concept, but we never talk about land control. And land is where people live, and land is where these problems emanate from. So to really affect those competitions, to really try to isolate populations from organizations who have transnational terrorist and other agendas that threaten our interests, I think that we have to be able to we have to remember that war is an extension of politics, and that what our army should bring to the joint force is an ability to set security conditions for sustainable political outcomes consistent with our vital interests. I mean, how else can you do that from the aerospace and maritime domains? I would say no. I don't think we can operate effectively on land without adequate capability in our Air Force and our Navy. You know, and so this can't be a zero-sum game discussion. You know, but we have to be able to achieve sustainable political outcomes consistent with our vital interests. Otherwise, we're just stirring up the pot and leaving. You know, and the problem doesn't go away. The second big continuity is war is human, and I think that we have to understand the psychological, cultural dimension of conflict, and be able to operate effectively, based on our understanding of the human dimension of war. One of the big aspects of that is related to the third, which is war is uncertain. You can't predict with a high degree of certainty the future course of events in war, and that's in between wars or in the course of a war, and that's because of the continuous interaction with the enemy. And the unpredictable nature of what enemies will do. Oftentimes, I think we in the U.S., either in the context of a war, and I think we did this in Iraq to a certain extent, and in between wars, our tendency is to decide what we would like to do based on maybe fiscal constraints or what seems attractive to do, right? And then assume that that's going to be relevant to the problem of armed conflict, and so. So we make these projections into the future that are unrealistic, and as a result we create vulnerabilities that our enemies exploit, and when we create those vulnerabilities, obviously we lose our deterrence capability as well, and there's a greater likelihood for conflict. So the human dimension of war's unpredictable nature, I think you could say that U.S. war planning at times, and even force development planning at times, appears almost narcissistic, right? Because we define the world only in relation to us and what we would like to do. And then the fourth thing I think is important is related to the three above, is that war is still a contest of wills. And sometimes, it has become fashionable some people are reluctant to talk about winning in war. And I think, obviously, in the conflicts we've been in, you can't track progress in war on a map, and toward the capture of an enemy's capital city or the defeat of a fielded armed force. But I think we can do better at defining, again, this sustainable political outcome consistent with our vital interests, and then communicate our willingness to see it through. So the big lessons, I think, are four key continuities in war. War is an extension of politics. War is human dimension. War is uncertainty and nonlinearity. And then war is... as a contest of wills. And there are implications, I think, all the way through our army in terms of how we prepare, our soldiers and units to operate in that context. Things that we've learned that are bad habits, I think that really the lessons we learned from the last 12 years might be as even more important than the outcome of those wars. And so this is a really important question, I think. And I think that there is a competition between this view of war as an extension of politics and what I would call a raiding mentality or a raiding approach to the problem of war. And the raiding approach is basically an attrition-based approach to war that is a evolution of strategic bombing theory that goes back to Douay. And it basically is that if you can understand the enemy's nodes, critical enemy nodes, and then if you can raid against those nodes, either with firepower delivered from the aerospace or maritime domains, or physical raids conducted by typically special forces units, then you can win in war, and you can win fast, cheap, efficient, and at low cost. And I would say that that's a fundamentally unrealistic conception of really how you can solve the problem of future war. Those who advocate this tend to learn, I think, also another wrong lesson of these wars, because we know, right, that raiding and the attrition approach did not solve the problem in Iraq. We know that it did not solve the problem or get us on a course toward consolidating gains and hardening the Afghan state against the regenerative capacity of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And we talk more about that. So that's one wrong lesson, I think, is that the future to future American defense strategy should be a raiding strategy. The second wrong lesson is that I think we have exaggerated what we can accomplish through proxies, essentially, or partners, right? And this is the by, with, and through thing. You know, hey, the problem of future war, man, it looks ugly. You know, we're in a fiscal constraints. Therefore, let's just outsource it to other armies, and then we can provide small advisory teams that can then improve their capabilities, and we can get them to fight wars in a way that are consistent with our vital interests. And that last part is the problematic part, is that our interests are oftentimes not congruent with those of our so-called partners. And of course, there are many examples of this that we can learn from in both Afghanistan and in Iraq. In Iraq, we were focused, and these are the arguments that focus around building partner capacity. And I think whenever anyone hears building partner capacity, just ask, what about the politics, right? Whose capacity are we building? How does that capacity relate to who's in power within these security forces and how they would use that power and whether or not that's consistent with our interests? And so in Iraq, for example, and Chris Schnaubelt, who's here, did some really groundbreaking work on first uncovering this problem set, is that we were enthusiastically building capacity for Iraqi police forces and the Ministry of Interior, and those forces were largely captured by Shia Islamist militias that were, to some degree, under the direction of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps of Iran. And those forces that we were building capacity within were engaged in the sectarian cleansing campaigns in the mixed sectarian areas of Baghdad and then up the Tigris River Valley. And so, you know, that's one example. Another example is obviously our efforts to develop the Malian Army's capability prior to the defection of units, some of which we trained, to Al-Qaeda. Another example is training Afghan security forces, some of which were captured by criminal patronage networks who were instrumental in establishing exclusionary political economies that left key elements of the population outside the tent, and that was a driver for perpetuating some local conflicts and a driver for support for the Taliban. So I think scary lesson number one is war is raiding, and we can take a raiding approach. Scary lesson number two is don't worry about American military capacity going down, because we'll be able to outsource wars to other armies. I think that's another wrong lesson. Other skills that I think are critical for us to regain have to do with skills that have atrophied based on these being mature theaters of war and us being able to establish and build infrastructure over time. So what are those? I think some of those are really associated with our Army's ability to fight campaigns. And we have to think about how we fight campaigns with larger formations in austere environments and complex environments and against determined enemies. So obviously, joint forcible entry and early entry operations are critical. The logistics of moving, you know, armored brigades, striker brigades, and infantry and airborne brigades into a theater, and to have the force with the sufficient combined arms capability and mobility to accomplish the mission. This is joint logistics over the shore. It's a sea lift, airlift capability, extremely important for us to get this right and to think about, you know, how we do this effectively and based on what we see as plausible contingencies in the future. And then once there, you know, how do we conduct effective reconnaissance and security operations prior to entering into decisive operations? And We've changed a lot of our formations in our Army, and our formations are now, we do not have formations that can integrate intelligence and operations to develop the situation for a division or higher level commander. Those responsibilities have devolved into or down onto the intelligence community. They can't answer the question. They can answer part of the question, but because of enemy countermeasures, you can never really understand what you need to understand in advance to making decisions. So reconnaissance and security, I think, is something we have to focus on across the board. And then logistics, how to sustain high-tempo operations at the end of extended and contested lines of communication. That's an important problem for us. And then another problem for that is associated with that is how to sustain our freedom of movement and action at the end of those extended and contested lines of communication. That has a lot to do with enemy countermobility, rocket capabilities. How do we protect the force as we're maneuvering? So really two big strategic lessons that could be scary if we learn the wrong lessons, and then some skill sets that have atrophied in our Army that we have to get back. And of course, I forgot to mention establishing and maintaining communication, you know, across those wide areas, command and control, what we're calling mission command in the Army.
All right, let's see if you guys have any scary questions for General McMaster. Nate, you want to start, and then JP?
Absolutely. General, it's good to see you again. Welcome to CSIS.
Thanks.
I'm going to ask a question about the integration of the different ground elements, the Army, Marine Corps, and SOF. Yeah. And there's a number of components to that, but just I think what would be most important to this audience, and I think that the tenor of these questions is, how do you see their various roles individually? Okay. How do you see their collective roles when employed together? And what are the circumstances under which you'd see them deployed in large numbers again?
Right. Those are great questions. Well, there are certain skill sets that only our special forces can do, and they're the best at them. And, you know, that strategic reconnaissance is really a key task. Unconventional warfare is something that I think, you know, you're not going to see conventional forces operate, in that role particularly. But then there are a broad range of skill sets that have to overlap and that we have to do together. And I think that those we can envision that interaction and that integration of special forces in a broad range of contingencies. First of all, our special forces' ability to conduct foreign internal defense and combat advisory mission sets. We can augment their capability to do that easily, and we can do that in a number of ways. First of all, to give our leaders, I cannot imagine an environment that we would go in where there would not be some multinational component to the mission. So how do we develop in our leaders those skill sets associated with foreign internal defense and combat advisory skill sets? The other thing is we can provide additional logistics and firepower to those special forces teams. So I think you should think of a scout section in the future, which an armored brigade is 12 soldiers and two Bradley fighting vehicles. They ought to have the capability of being an ODA minus in terms of FID capabilities with chain guns, you know, and with comms and access to joint fires capabilities and so forth. And to augment so we can operate with larger indigenous forces. And so that's an area of key overlap. In mission sets, I think that we should be able to task organize on the fly. So if you have an area, for example, that could be maybe an economy of force area because you have relatively capable indigenous security forces in a lower threat area, that becomes a joint special operations area of operation. And then you can attach conventional forces to augment them, aviation and ground forces and logistics and engineers and so forth. And we've done this on the fly. We've done it without formal command relationships. We did it, you know, we have OpCon and so forth. We did it under WarCon. You know, this made sense to do in the war. So we got to sustain that kind of flexibility across all of our formations and ability to operate with special forces. You know, obviously, an area of key overlap is in joint forceable entry operations. You know, and there's no body better to do that than our special operators, right? But we have to have greater depth in that capability, and that's what General Allen in 18th Airborne Corps and General Nicholson in 82nd have been working on. And what we have to learn from each other on a continuous basis. You know, they have certain capabilities they've developed that are expeditionary that we could migrate into the conventional force. so forth. So I think, you know, foreign internal defense, combat advisory missions, you know, really being able to task, organize on the fly and operate together, a migration of foreign internal defense and combat advisory skills into the maneuver force, and then obviously joint forcible entry and early entry operations being an area of key overlap, you know, with our special forces units and our Ranger regiment in particular, and with combined with our airborne and our infantry brigade combat teams.
Is this on? The ODNI threat assessment of 12 March indicates that the areas of the world's most likely to create instability and conflict remain in the Middle East and North Africa, with the exception of North Korea. Yet the national security strategy directs a shift in focus to the Asia Pacific. How can land power best prepare to mitigate this contradiction?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we can't be, if you're a global power with global interests, obviously, you can't focus only on one single region, and I think that it can't be a false dilemma. You know, we can't make it a false dilemma or a false choice, false dichotomy. You know, either the Middle East or Asia, and so I think that Army forces have a very strong role to play, obviously in the Middle East and in Asia. You know, I think the top five largest armies in the world are in Asia, and so if we want to shape environments in a positive way, build relationships that can help achieve stability and counter potential threats, then our Army is going to play a very significant role in doing that. In both the Middle East and in Asia, you know, we already play a very strong deterrent role. You know, and it's consistent with really the inadequacy of relying exclusively on naval power in 433 BC during the Peloponnesian Wars. You know, I mean, you know, the prospect of something bad happening to somebody in the future doesn't tend to deter them. You know, it's really, you know, a forward presence and an ability to make a potential enemy understand that there would be severe consequences if they were to undertake aggressive action or aggression. And so obviously our forces in Korea, you know, play that role, and our forces more broadly in Asia will play that role. Our forces in Kuwait play a very similar role now in connection with other potential adversaries in that region, and as a hedge against what could be some negative contingencies that would develop in the Middle East as well. And so I think there's the partnership part of it, and there's also the deterrent. I think under the strategy, you know, the prevent, shape, aspects of the defense strategy, the Army forces play a very important role. And to answer your question, how to mitigate what is an apparent contradiction between developments in the Middle East from Syria to Levant to what happened recently in the West Bank. To the potential bleed over what's happening in Syria and Lebanon, to the Kurd Arab issue in Iraq, to the sectarian violence in Iraq, to the actions and activities of Iran, to the Yemen situation. I mean, obviously there are a lot of problems in the Middle East that could threaten our vital interests, and so we just have to be prepared for a broad range of contingencies, I think.
So one of the questions is on regional alignment. Actually, there's a couple of questions on regional alignment. The Army's going through a process now of regional aligning forces at some level for different purposes. The question is that concept is it a universal one, or should it be tailored to a specific region? Should, for example, forces that are aligned to one region have a different mission focus and a different validation process than forces that are aligned to another region, and if so, how do you manage a process like that? I think those will suffice for.
Okay, great. Well, I think regional alignment is just it's a great idea, right? I think for one of the reasons is it's a great driver for leader development, education, and for training. So just by paying attention to the dynamics within a region that could evolve into a severe or serious threat against our interests or those of allies, you know, we can build you know, kind of genericized scenarios into our training and make sure that when we brief, you know, a five-paragraph field order situation, it used to just be about the enemy in context of the terrain and weather. Okay, now we have to consider the enemies in context of the terrain and the population and the political dynamics and the other dynamics that affect your mission. So I think it'll make sure that we, you know, we're thinking holistically about potential problems and then how we would conduct military operations in the context of those problem sets. The key is really going to be the connection to the joint force and the combatant commanders in particular, and also the interagency planning that should go on that pulls in really the regional teams at state and also certainly the ambassadors, you know, and really what this regional alignment will do is give our ambassadors an additional tool to engage with militaries consistent with what they're trying to achieve diplomatically, you know. So I think it's going to give us much greater depth in terms of, you know, theater security cooperation, international military education and training. You know, we can host leaders from these organizations or do small scale, you know, exercises and so forth that help develop the kind of common understanding. Now, if you think about what is the payoff of that operationally, there's a payoff in prevent and shape, you know, certainly, right? There's a payoff in leader development, education, and training. But there's also a payoff if we do have to conduct a contingency operation. You know, if the French had not been physically present and understood the dynamics in really neighboring countries to Mali, could they have done what they had done? Have the degree of understanding, have the access, right, to bases in an adjacent country to be able to conduct that extremely effective operation. So I think there's huge payoff in regional alignment. I see it as all goodness, because, you know, it provides additional capacity to our ambassadors, to our combatant commanders, and it helps educate us better, and it doesn't prevent us from being flexible. I mean, just because a brigade or division or a corps is aligned with the region doesn't mean it can't be employed somewhere else.
Three questions on unmanned systems. So do you envision ground drones in formations, and if so, how would they be used in the future?
Okay. Well, yes. I mean, we're going to have, obviously, access to and integrate into all of our formations, unmanned ground systems. And I think there's tremendous potential associated with them. So we are the maneuver center is the lead, the Army's lead for unmanned ground system development. And so we're working in coordination with the other centers of excellence, in particular, you know, the engineer school and the maneuver support center, you know, who've done some great work, and the research labs have done some great work in terms of identifying obstacles and breaching obstacles, IEDs, reducing IEDs and so forth. And we're also paying really close attention to the Fort Rucker with unmanned aerial vehicles. They have the lead for that, and obviously the whole joint program for unmanned systems. Because what we want to do is we want to make sure that our unmanned ground systems, how we develop them and the doctrine we develop, is informed by how they're doing manned and unmanned teaming in Army aviation. They've made, I think, some really important strides there. We want to make sure that what we're procuring is consistent with what we're doing in the joint perspective and across the Army, because what we've seen is a proliferation of systems, surveillance systems, technical intelligence collection systems, for example, but we haven't caught up to integrating those systems. So if you think about an area security operation over wide areas, and you want to do that consistent with, you know, the fundamentals of security, which I'm a big fan of, right, you know, conduct continuous reconnaissance, and as part of that, gaining and maintaining contact with the enemy, orienting on what you're trying to protect, freedom of movement on a route, facilities. You might be protecting an activity, development of indigenous security forces, for example, but area security operations over these wide areas. And you're conducting combinations of offensive, defensive, reconnaissance, security, and raids to do that. What you need to do as a fundamental of security is maintain continuous observation of critical areas. Can we integrate those into command posts, and can we connect that surveillance capability, essentially early warning of enemy activity or other activity, can we connect that to the people who are going to do something about that at the lower tactical level, right? So we have tremendous capability in our Air Force ISR wings. How do we get the same degree of air-ground integration with those long-duration strategic-level assets at the platoon level that you have with Army rotary wing aircraft now? Can we get the comms in place? Can we get the downlinks in place so you can use a rover or the next version to be able to get the imagery right there? So there are a lot of, we want to do this, apply this to ground vehicles as well, and we want our ground vehicles obviously to provide early warning of enemy activity, to help us make contact on our own terms, to help maintain contact once contact is made, to help us integrate all arms into the fight, to help ensure our freedom of maneuver and action. We're going to use them to lighten our soldiers' load, you know, as well, so we can operate at greater distance dismounted. And so it's an exciting time, I think, and we are, you know, refining our requirements and staying plugged into the unmanned aerial vehicle effort and the joint, you know, unmanned systems effort.
And we do one more? And yep. Sorry, is that all right?
Yep, sure, yeah, definitely.
The Army, in particular, its documents are proliferated with the term decisive. And the question I think we all should consider is, in light of what we've experienced over the last 12 years and looking forward at these very complex environments, what is decisive going to mean going forward?
Okay. Well, it really depends on the nature of the contingency, right? And again, this is the difficult part of the business of trying to get to a sustainable political outcome consistent with your interests. Fundamentally, our Army has to do, really, we operate consistent with two competencies. Combined arms maneuver, which is the integration of all arms and conducting fire and maneuver to seize, retain, and exploit the initiative over enemy organizations and ultimately defeat enemy organizations. And then we have to be able to conduct area security operations over wide areas to consolidate gains and to help shape outcomes consistent with our those vital interests. And we could think of a number of contingencies where we'd have to do that, but if you just look at what we had to do in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's exactly what we really had to do. If you look at what the French have had to do in Mali, that's what they've had to do, now turning over as rapidly as they can to African forces, but they essentially went into a combined arms maneuver mission set and then went into an area of security. Now, you have to be able to do these things simultaneously as well. So I would think that would be, you know, really what is decisive, okay, is how you can defeat enemy, employ Army forces as part of joint forces and interagency efforts to defeat enemy organizations and consolidate gains and set security conditions to fill in the blank, what you're trying to achieve politically. I think the word decisive, you know, can be problematic, right, because you don't want it to be construed as the old RDO, rapid decisive operations, you know, which I liken to the, you know, kind of the George Costanza on Seinfeld, leave on an up note, you know what I mean? Just go in, do a lot of damage, and leave, you know? So what have you really achieved if you do that? So you know, it's decisive, though, means that I think that until you employ land power as part of a joint team, the enemy really still continues to have a vote on what to do next, right? So you have not placed, oftentimes, something of value to the enemy at a high enough risk where that enemy either is forced to react to you and have an opportunity to defeat that enemy force, or you can isolate that enemy from a source of strength and its capabilities. So I think that's what decisive means, you know, and so targeting does not equal tactics and strategy and policy. And I think that is, you know, again, you know, a potentially dangerous lesson, you know, if we learn the wrong lesson of recent wars. But I take your point on decisive. We just have to be careful about how we use it. I think we use it well, you know, and what we see in our doctrine, I'll tell you, Army doctrine's a page turner. If you guys haven't read it, it's springtime. It's beach reading. Take it to the beach. And so, our new manuals are the best manuals I think we've ever had. You know, so if you want to understand what the Army thinks about how it fights, read our 3.ADRP 3.0. And really in there we talk, really emphasize seizing, retaining, and exploiting the initiative. The sequel to that, you know, is Mission Command, which is a great manual. And then our leader development manuals, I think, are really key, as is our training manual and so forth. So those are, you know, what are they, 30, 40 pages, Ricky? Some 10 pages. So you can whip through them, and you know, they come in a snappy box set, or you can get it online.
So don't crash the Tradox server, everyone. General McMaster, thanks so much for coming and talking with us today. We really appreciate it. We look forward to the history you'll make, and we'd love to have you come back shortly in the future.
Thanks, Martha. It was a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
That was great.